From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. If Lou Gehrig didn't have his namesake disease, then what did he have? This week on Only a Game, an exploration of recent findings that an ALS-like disease is linked to head trauma. Also chronicling Roger Clemens' missteps that led to federal charges, and play-by-play announcers discuss the intricacies and peculiar charms of chess. Also, author Michael Weinreb talks about his new book, Bigger Than the Game, which makes the case that today's overhyped modern athlete can be traced to a particular point in time.
They're all sort of paying homage to this moment in the 80s when you had guys like McMahon and like, you know, Brian Bosworth, who were very much playing to the cameras and playing to the media and building up their personality through these moments on television.
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, a federal grand jury indicted former Major League pitcher Roger Clemens on 6 counts, including 1 count of obstruction of Congress and 2 counts of perjury. The charges stem from testimony Clemens gave in 2008 before a House committee examining steroid use in baseball. Joining me now to discuss the latest development in Clemens' legal troubles is Houston Chronicle columnist Richard Justice. Richard, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill.
In 2008, Roger Clemens denied using performance-enhancing drugs during his testimony before Congress. Could you summarize some of the key developments since then that have led to this indictment?
Well, I think what basically happened is that Republicans and Democrats on the Hill that day on the committee took a very different line of approach with the questioning. Republicans were very careful in the way they approached Clemens. Democrats were very critical. But at the when they were done, leaders from both parties believe that Clemens had lied to them, and they asked for an investigation. 2.5 years later, indictments have come down. The feds have been pretty clear that they've been going after, looking under every rock and crevice. What else has happened in that time is investigative reporting has stripped open a lot of very embarrassing aspects of Roger Clemens' personal life. Clearly, I know for a fact they've been hurtful to his son, who is in the minor leagues, and probably to his wife as well.
In your Thursday column, you wrote that Clemens' quote, own decisions carried him down this sorry road. What seems so remarkable now is that Roger Clemens' testimony before Congress was voluntary. What were his major other missteps?
The lesson of steroids, one of the many lessons of steroids, is that fans still want to put these guys on a pedestal. The players who have come forward and said, listen, I did it, I'm sorry, especially Andy Pettitte, have been forgiven. It's almost become a footnote in their careers. Those who have fought it have put themselves in legal jeopardy on some level. And the thing is, Clemens chose his path. And it's so sad, Bill, because the guy I knew was a great teammate, not just a great player. He was a great teammate. He was a guy that other players felt they could call in the middle of the night. But he was a really caring guy, and toward the end of his career, as he went around on minor league assignments, he would do little things like hold clinics for young players. He would buy furniture for clubhouses. None of that's going to be remembered. What's going to be remembered is that he and Barry Bonds are the Mount Rushmore figures in baseball steroid scandal.
After the indictment came down Thursday, Roger Clemens tweeted, I never took HGH or steroids, and I did not lie to Congress. I look forward to challenging the government's accusations. Do you think he will ever change his stance?
Apparently not, because now I think he understands. You know, when you're a professional athlete and you've had your shoes kissed every room you walk into for 25 or 30 years, there's the danger of your value system getting screwed up, that you decide that you play by the rules you set the rules. And in this game with federal prosecutors and perjury charges and that, he didn't set the rules. And I guess he didn't understand it. You know, he took upon himself. He did a lobbying tour of Capitol Hill before his testimony. And I guess it gave him confidence as legislators asked for his autograph and posed for pictures with him and all that. I think he decided that I will bluster my way through this. A colleague of mine, Peter Gammons, wrote that Roger approached this as if he were jawing with an umpire trying to get a call, or staring down a sports writer after a game, not maybe fully understanding or not wanting to understand or thinking the rules didn't apply to him, that this was a completely different game.
Roger Clemens attended the University of Texas. He pitched for the Houston Astros for 3 seasons. He lives in Texas now. How are his fellow Texans responding to the news of these indictments?
Well, he left the Astros to go back to the Yankees, and so that, in a fan's mentality, that put him in a negative light. He has taken a very low profile. When he pitched for the Astros, he was the number one personality or celebrity in the city of Houston. He replaced George and Barbara Bush in that role. He was number one on your list if you had a charity function, and he was very gracious with his time. I saw him about a month ago at the Texas League All-Star Game in Midland. His son, Kobe, was playing in the game. And for just a moment, he pitched batting practice, he signed autographs, he posed for pictures, he got a nice ovation. And for just that night, it was almost like this is the way it should have been all along.
The charges Clemens is facing carry a maximum sentence of 30 years in prison and a $1.5 million fine. I haven't spoken with anybody who thinks that that's going to be the result of all this, but what do you think the outcome of the case will be?
The history of federal indictments is that the conviction rate is very high, over 90%. And so just a reasonable person would conclude he is looking at a couple of guilty pleas and maybe some jail time. It will be not much, maybe token jail time, but you know, Bill, what he's lost beyond jail time or fines or any of that is he's lost his good name. He's lost his chance to go into the Hall of Fame. He's lost his reputation. Those are things, probably even an acquittal notwithstanding, he can't get back. That's the real sadness and the real price he has paid.
But it's all something that most people would say, by his conduct, he's probably brought upon himself.
No question. And I think what made him great was his inability to give in, to concede anything. And he's approached this part of his life exactly the same way. And the cost have been just beyond comprehension almost.
Richard Justice writes for the Houston Chronicle. You can find a link to his latest column about Roger Clemens at our website, onlyagame.org. Richard, thanks very much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Bill.
It's not news that multiple concussions, no matter how one suffers them, can lead to problems ranging from failing memory and headaches to dementia and various degrees of disability. A study published on Wednesday in the Journal of Neuropathology and Experimental Neurology posits that head injuries can also lead to a condition very similar to amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, better known as Lou Gehrig's disease. According to Boston University neuropathologist Anne McKee, the co-author of the study, the condition she and her colleagues have described could easily be mistaken for ALS in various symptomatic former athletes.
Clinically, it looks a lot like ALS. These individuals were diagnosed as having ALS by major teaching hospitals. They had EMGs and electrophysiological studies. They had very definitive clinical histories, and they were thought to have ALS. But when we examined the brain and spinal cord, we found a different pathological pattern than you see in ALS. We saw buildup of two proteins, tau and this protein called TDP43, in both the brain and the spinal cord, and that is something you do not see in sporadic ALS.
The identification of chronic traumatic encephalomyelopathy was featured on a segment of the HBO series Real Sports on Tuesday evening. The report featured Steve Smith, who played football for Penn State and the Oakland Raiders. Smith now requires constant care and a respirator. He can communicate only by accessing a computer keyboard with eye movements. His condition is irreversible. The day after the program ran, Dr. McKee talked about the result of the exposure it had given her research, which depends in part on people donating their brains and spinal cords so that she can examine them.
just in the last day and a half since the report's been out, I've been inundated with emails from people that are interested in the study, people that maybe were thinking about it before, but now they definitely want to sign up, or they may know individuals that are similarly affected.
Real Sports reporter Bernard Goldberg dramatically pressed Anne McKee and her colleague Chris Nowinski to agree with him that their research represented a breakthrough in the understanding of ALS.
Has anyone, until now I guess, proven that anything in particular, anything causes ALS?
About 10% of cases are known to be caused by genetics. Other than that, doctors throw up their hands. They've never known. They've never been able to prove the link.
This is the first ever known cause of ALS.
Yes, you could say that.
That's a major breakthrough.
Yeah.
A day after Real Sports aired, Anne McKee explained why the program hadn't acknowledged the distinction between the two pathologies.
We had gone over that, and I think they felt for the average viewer that would just be too complicated. So they opted to make it a simplistic presentation.
As the New York Times and various other publications have since made clear, Anne McKee's study posits that the degenerative condition similar to ALS is related to head injuries suffered by soldiers as well as football players, soccer players, boxers, hockey players, and wrestlers. Dr. McKee's research suggests that Lou Gehrig, who suffered at least half a dozen head injuries during his career with the Yankees, may have had chronic traumatic encephalomyelopathy rather than ALS, the disease that bears his name. Jonathan Eig, Gehrig's biographer, points out that the most accomplished physicians of that era confidently diagnosed ALS in the man known as the Iron Horse, but he acknowledges that Lou Gehrig might have begun sustaining head injuries even before he began playing 2,130 consecutive games for the Yankees.
He was a great football player. He might have made an excellent career in football, except that the money wasn't as good. He was a punter as well as a halfback, and he was a guy that would just put his head down and plow through that line. And he was so big and so strong, even at the age of 16, 17, he had these massive thighs that just churned like freight engines, and he would just dive right in and push the line back with him.
Familiar with how inspirational Lou Gehrig's story has been for people suffering from ALS, as well as those dedicated to discovering more about causes and possible treatments, Jonathan Eig is confident that Lou Gehrig will always have a role in the fight against the disease.
His picture is in almost every neurologist's office that I've ever visited. If they're a neurologist who deals a lot with ALS, they show their patients this picture of Lou Gehrig, this big, strong man, and they remind him that Gehrig did not die weakly. He went out, though his muscles were fading, he went out with a great deal of strength in his character and the way he handled his illness, and I don't think that will ever change.
Did Lou Gehrig die of CTEM rather than ALS? The question will never be answered, and to Anne McKee, it's as nothing compared to the potential benefits of the research in which she has been involved.
Trauma may induce an ALS-like disease gives us an enormous insight into the process that's going on in the brains and spinal cords of these individuals. And hopefully we can come up with effective treatments, either to slow it down or reverse it, and maybe even completely eliminate it.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Zoltan Landvi learned to skateboard in 1979 when he was 14, but he didn't begin to regard skateboarding as part of his calling until several decades later, after he had become a priest. Now, he not only preaches in Riedix, a small Hungarian village, he also wheels around the parish collecting potential parishioners. He recently shared a few of his skateboarding stunts with three teenagers who'd never been to church, then reported that all three had begun coming regularly to Mass. Many times I have felt that this is the way I can bring many people closer to Jesus, Father Landvi recently said of skateboarding, and pressed he'd probably acknowledge that it's fun. Hey. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, announcers doing chess play-by-play, or is it move-by-move? But first, on Tuesday, the New York Mets announced that their contract with pitcher Francisco Rodriguez would no longer be guaranteed. A few days earlier, Rodriguez was arrested for allegedly assaulting the 53-year-old grandfather of his twin sons at the Mets' home stadium, Citi Field. During the alleged attack, Rodriguez suffered a season-ending hand injury, and he will forfeit over $3 million of his 2010 salary. On Wednesday, the players' union filed a grievance. Close attention is being paid to the case because the outcome could give Major League Baseball's owners unprecedented power or considerably limit it. Here to discuss this matter and the issue of athletes and violence is Sports Illustrated columnist Jeff Benedict. Jeff, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back, Bill.
The last time a Major League team tried to convert a contract was in 2005, when the Baltimore Orioles attempted to do that to the contract of pitcher Sidney Ponson after a drunk driving arrest. The player and the team settled. Ponson walked with nearly all of his salary. Do you think that's likely to happen in the Rodriguez dispute?
There certainly are some things that have changed since then. If you get outside baseball and look generally at the professional leagues, you're seeing an increased effort on the part of the commissioners to crack down on the off-the-field behavior that affects the on-the-field performance of the players. You saw what Commissioner Stern did earlier this year with a couple of players who carried some guns into a locker room. They were knocked out for the entire season, raised a lot of eyebrows, but sent a message, and it stood. I think that this case is important for a lot of reasons. Domestic violence is a big problem. His case is kind of outrageous because it happened in the workplace with witnesses all around and security guards. So I think the Mets are on some solid ground here.
In 1987, the San Diego Padres tried to void the contract of pitcher Lamar Hoyt after he was caught returning to the United States from Mexico with 500 painkillers in his pants. The Padres' move was denied by an arbitrator, but as a result, teams began adding clauses that would void contracts for bad behavior off the field. Are you surprised that 23 years later, more teams haven't at least tried to void more than a small handful of contracts?
The leagues have been slow to come around to the idea that off-the-field criminal behavior really matters to the integrity and productivity of the game. They've always been interested in things like gambling because it goes to the heart of whether the game is real.
Mm.
You know, they've looked at things like sexual assault, domestic violence, alcohol abuse, and stuff like that. Those are issues for the courts to deal with. But I think more and more owners are seeing that it actually has a big impact on what happens on Sunday or on Tuesday night in the stadium. Players that have these problems, they're a huge distraction. They're disruptive in the clubhouse. And so, I think it's a good thing that some of the teams are starting to take a harder look at being able to exercise the morality clause in a contract in instances like this.
Francisco Rodriguez isn't the only athlete in the news for an off-field incident. Tell us about the case involving Indiana Pacers draft pick Lance Stephenson and the reaction from team president Larry Bird.
Well, Lance Stephenson was indicted for a felony sexual assault case that involved a girl that was in his high school. He and another teammate were charged. He pled guilty to a reduced disorderly conduct charge, a misdemeanor. And he went to Cincinnati on a scholarship last year, was the Big East Player of the Year, and then declared early to come into the NBA draft, which he did this summer, and the Pacers picked him. Now he's got an incident over the weekend where he's been arrested again, this time for allegedly assaulting the mother of his child and throwing her down the stairs in New York. And he's facing felony charges, which carry a 7-year minimum. Larry Bird's response initially was, "We're monitoring this." Then he followed up with another statement saying he was very disappointed. This went against the kind of thing that they've told their players, and that he hadn't decided what he was going to do, but essentially whatever it is going to send a strong message to the community, etc. To me, this is not a hard one. To me, this is a case where you just say, you know what, you're not putting on a uniform and playing for this team until this case is resolved. And if it isn't resolved in your favor, then you may never play here.
It's often said that the indiscretions of athletes and even the criminal acts of athletes are more likely to be publicized because they're professional athletes, and they suffer for that. Is that a fair assessment at all?
There's no doubt about it. In fact, I did a study, Bill, back in the late 90s, which showed that professional and college athletes had a higher likelihood of being arrested. Police, when they investigate these crimes, they are more aggressive and they go harder after an athlete because they know the media is watching. And there have been allegations in the past of law enforcement giving preferential treatment to celebrity athletes. The flip side of that, though, is that athletes also stand a much greater chance of being exonerated. They can afford to hire the best criminal defense lawyers. And the other thing is, juries typically like athletes, and particularly when you're talking about cases where the accuser is a woman and it's a sex assault case, it's really easy to portray that person as a groupie, a woman who, you know, pursued this guy, because those things are out there and they're real.
Do athletes commit domestic violence and other criminal acts more often than people of the same age in the general population?
We did a national study back in the mid-90s. It was the first and still the only one that's been done. We looked at colleges, Division I schools with top football and basketball teams. 3% of the males on these campuses were student-athletes, yet they were responsible for about 19% of the reported incidents of violence against women on those campuses. That's a big problem, and that's a fair way to compare, because you're basically comparing student-athletes on a campus to the rest of the guys on a campus. When you get beyond that and you get in the general population, you look at pro athletes, who do you compare them to? I mean, these are guys that are generally between the ages of 19 and 30, many of whom are African-American, and most of them are making over $1 million a year in income. It's hard to find a social group in the United States to match them with. And so what you end up doing is you just look at how many of these players are committing crimes, and in the NBA and the NFL, it's right around 20% that have records involving serious offenses. What other industry can you point to in the United States where one out of four employees has a record?
Let's get back to the case of Francisco Rodriguez and his alleged punching out of the father of his common-law wife. Do you think the Mets' action against him this week will do anything to change the landscape?
Well, if you'd asked me that question a few days ago, I would have said no, because their initial reaction was to suspend him for 2 games. But now that they've made a move to basically get out of a contract, that, on the other hand, I think does get people's attention and has the potential to have a big impact. And I'm sure a lot of players and teams are going to watch for the outcome of this.
Jeff Benedict is a columnist for Sports Illustrated and the author of Out of Bounds, Inside the NBA's Culture of Rape, Violence, and Crime, and the author of Pros and Cons, The Criminals Who Play in the NFL. Jeff, thanks very much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Anyone who follows sports has heard broadcasters refer to a game as a chess match, or perhaps to an athlete who's in check or a pawn in the game. But what about those commentators who mean those terms literally? Only a Game's Rachel Lipman attended 2 St. Louis area tournaments this year. She spent time with chess play-by-play announcers broadcasting for the web-only Internet Chess Club, who hope to someday bring the coverage of chess into more homes. She has this report.
The meme that chess is boring is pervasive enough to be the basis for an insurance company's new television ad.
Could switching to GEICO really save you 15% or more on car insurance? Can football announcer Andres Cantor make any sport exciting?
Beyond cuts to Cantor watching elite athletes focused intently on their game. As the camera zooms out, the viewer sees 2 men sitting at a chessboard. Cantor gets more and more excited as a hand moves toward a piece. Then...
You know, it's crushing blows, it's devastating moves, it's spectacular ideas. They may look like they're sitting there quietly pondering some kind of calculus formulas, but they're actually thinking, I want to whip his ass.
Jamaican native Maurice Ashley pays the bills by coaching chess. But in 1996 and again in 2003, he was part of the ESPN team that broadcast the man versus machine matches of Garry Kasparov. And he was behind the mic in a basement broadcast booth for the 2009 and 2010 U.S. Chess Championships, which were held in St. Louis.
I'm all about the energy. I'm all about who's getting killed, who's getting their feelings hurt, who's going to lose, and not how is he going to be able to come back from it. People can relate to that.
Ashley honed his chess skills in the parks of New York City, where trash talking abounds. He likes to carry that over to his broadcasts, which led Sports Illustrated to call him the John Madden of chess. That would make Jennifer Shahadi Pat Summerall. It's not a perfect parallel, since Ashley's often the one describing the action. But Shahadi plays the straight man well.
So you're saying you like Nakamura's position? You take black here?
Yeah, definitely.
Really?
Black is extraordinarily comfortable in a position like
this. Don't you
worry
about your king?
I worry about my king all the time. That's part of the job description.
And that's the point of chess, in 5 seconds or less. Shahadi is a red-headed Philadelphian with a funky sense of style. She's also a 2-time U.S. women's champion. And though she's stepped away from competition to work as the web editor for Chess Life magazine, she uses her past tournament experience in her broadcasts on the Internet Chess Club, which is a main website for chess coverage.
We know how much stress there is when you're sitting there at the chessboard, so that's the goal, to kind of communicate that to people, the stress and the joy and the pain of the game.
The chess world is an insular one. Shahadi returned to St. Louis about 6 weeks after the U.S. championships to cover the women's and juniors tournaments for the ICC. That meant she was watching her friends play chess, which made it easy to speculate on their post-game strategy.
I think she probably won't watch the game. I think she might relax and just go to the pool and wait to see what happens.
Yeah, that sounds more like Krush's, that she would do that.
Irina Krush and Shahadi played each other for the 2003 women's championship. The man agreeing with Shahadi is Ben Feingold, the grandmaster in residence at the chess club and another veteran announcer. He was supposed to be Shahadi's broadcast partner for the U.S. championships before he was invited to play in that tournament. Feingold's weekly chess lectures, a job requirement, attract an audience with varying levels of skill. That forces him to talk about the game in more general terms, which he finds helpful for doing broadcasts.
Having somebody discuss the position and give what they think the players might do based on their personality and their style, and what's happening on the clock. Have they played this position before? This reminds me of another game. Not just be sort of stale and dry and talk about variations that would be boring to 99% of people.
The rules of chess are intricate, and the language sounds like gibberish to the uninitiated, which Shahadi says makes it like any other sport.
Actually, the rules to football or baseball are pretty complicated. So if you're watching a chess game and you're hearing all these awesome terms and so much excitement and you don't know the rules yet, you know what, maybe you're going to learn the rules after that.
At times during the hours of chess that made up the women's and juniors tournaments, the duo pulled off the feat of bringing excitement to a move that players had pondered for 15 minutes or more.
And we do have a move from Irina here. She has taken the pawn on c7, queen takes c7. And now if queen to d3, what will Krush do? Will she play rook e1?
And sometimes it was very easy to understand what had happened.
Abby Marshall, perhaps with knight d3, has made a big error, because this position looks dreadful.
As Yogi Berra once said, though, it ain't over till it's over. That dreadful move can throw an opponent off his or her game, and suddenly the favorite becomes the fallen. And that's when the human side comes out.
And Ray Robson has resigned.
Wow,
what a turnaround. His first loss of the event. Ray Robson definitely needs a hug right about now. At 15 years old, this is a heartbreaking loss for him.
Both Jennifer Shahadi and Ben Feingold say that human element will draw a bigger audience to chess. Shahadi thinks it will even crack the ESPN lineup again.
I've seen poker matches where they start talking about somebody eating a banana because there's nothing to talk about, you know? And I'm sitting around like, this is popular. We can get chess popular.
Poker has been a staple on ESPN for 20 years. Those games are highly edited for TV, she says, and chess matches would have to be as well. Shahadi, Feingold, and Maurice Ashley are not yet living the high-flying life of full-time correspondents, but there is at least one date penciled into their calendars. The Chess Club and Scholastic Center of St. Louis is scheduled to host the 2011 U.S. Championships, which means the basement broadcast room will be back in operation. For Only a Game, I'm Rachel Littman.
The indictment of Roger Clemens presents once again a challenge with which thoughtful sports fans have long been familiar. Do we allow what some of the athletes do off the field to diminish our delight in what they do or have done on it? They test us, these clowns, don't they? They get caught carrying guns onto airplanes, then go all wide-eyed and maintain that they'd forgotten the guns were in their luggage, or they say that the guns belonged to somebody else, or that the luggage did, or something. Or they bring their guns into their locker rooms. They slug old men and young women. They dose themselves with steroids, and then, if they're caught, they confess in words their attorneys have hired some other people to write. Or they say they thought it was flaxseed oil, or they shake their fingers at congressional committees, having previously signed autographs for the grandsons of the congressmen, and then we learn that they have tested positive. They drive recklessly and get into accidents, and alcohol is involved. They shoot themselves in the legs and other people in other places, or they hire people to do it. As their professional careers are only beginning while they're still living on college campuses, they steal computers and credit cards from their dorm mates. They speak of themselves in the third person and inhabit comic book personas. They make bad music. They get into the news for all sorts of other reasons that have nothing to do with points, wins, or championships, reasons like possession of a controlled substance with intent to commit stupidity, and we keep watching them because the games they play continue to be absorbing. In their best moments, they give us or have given us images of grace and excellence. They provide our days and nights with suspense and sometimes with an outlet for growling and griping that we might otherwise direct elsewhere. They make a kind of art, and if their brilliance is not lasting, perhaps we appreciate it all the more for that. The happy truth to which we cling, we fans of the games that are sometimes betrayed by those who play them, is that those games endure, and always will endure, the insults, great and small, intentional and unconscious, of those who play them at the highest levels. If you'd like to comment on something you've heard on Only a Game, please leave a message on our listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking. At nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
Vic Kleeman is a member of the American Coaster Enthusiasts, and it would be an understatement to say he is enthusiastic about roller coasters. On Sunday, in order to celebrate the 90th anniversary of a roller coaster called the Jackrabbit in Kennywood Park, West Mifflin, Pennsylvania, Mr. Kleeman, who is 78 years old, rode that Jackrabbit 90 times. This hardly qualified as remarkable since Mr. Kleeman has over 4,000 roller coaster rides to his credit. He first experienced the Jackrabbit, which has an 85-foot double-dip drop, in 1959. Sunday's marathon of 90 rides required about 5 hours. 5 hours Vic Kleeman will never see again. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, how guys with names like Bo and the Fridge and Boz changed our view of the modern athlete. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
Roger Clemens was indicted on perjury charges on Thursday. If convicted on all counts, he could face a maximum of 30 years in prison and a $1.5 million fine, although something less than 2 years would seem to be a good deal more likely. Does the potential punishment fit the alleged crime?
This is what the greatest scandal that there positively ever was has come to, a bunch of cheap perjury traps snaring a bunch of half-bright baseball players. I'm stunned. After a decade in which almost everybody who lied about much more significant events in Congress and out of Congress and under oath and not under oath has managed to skate, we're going to rejoice as a nation because we've run Roger Clemens to earth. This is embarrassing to a functioning democracy.
Bobby Thompson died on Monday. He was 86. Mr. Thompson hit 264 home runs over the course of his major league career, which ended back in 1960. One of those home runs was particularly memorable because it inspired Russ Hodges to shout, "The Giants win the pennant," a whole bunch of times on an autumn afternoon back in 1951. Most famous home run ever?
It's got to be because it infiltrated popular culture for decades after it actually happened. There's an episode of the TV series MASH that aired in 1980 that is encapsulates the year 1951, in which the central pivot is the pennant race between the Giants and the Dodgers, and ends with, well, of course, Bobby Thompson's home run. And it is, of course, the opening chapter in Don DeLillo's masterful Underworld. The chapter itself was released as an independent piece in Harper's called PAFCO at the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, I think without question the most famous home run. The only thing in the same ballpark is Babe Ruth calling a shot, and that may not have happened.
The Mets are trying to make baseball history of their own this week. They're attempting to dock the pay of star closer Francisco Rodriguez, who will miss the rest of the season after injuring his hand when he punched the father of his common-law wife.
Whoa, time out. Let's run the circumstances of the crime over again.
Yeah, but this took place on Mets property with lots of people in attendance. The union has filed a grievance, but do the Mets have a good case?
I don't know, because what they're trying to do is fairly well unprecedented, but it is shaping up as a major showdown between the Players Association and the management side of baseball. They would give owners a power they didn't have before this, so it'll be interesting to watch this going forward.
For the first time in franchise history, the San Diego Padres have swept the Chicago Cubs at Wrigley Field. The Padres have a significant lead now in the National League West without many big names on the roster. How are they doing it?
Well, you know, because they're not taking seriously the phony competitive balance argument that we hear from, you know, from baseball apologists everywhere that, no, we can't compete with the Yankees and the Red Sox. Guess what? Maybe you can't, but you can compete with the Padres. You can compete with the Twins. All you have to do is want to.
Brett Favre said of the Vikings this week, quote, "I owe it to this organization to give it one more try." So do you share Mr. Favre's read on his obligation to Minnesota?
I couldn't care less. Play, don't play, sit around with Cletus at the truck stop and eat pork rinds in Brucellosis Junction, Mississippi. I don't care what you do, Brett Favre, ever again in your life. I'll be tuning in December when you throw the inevitable playoff interception that costs your team the game.
Elsewhere in preseason pro football, former Indianapolis and Tampa Bay coach Tony Dungy has accepted an invitation from Jets coach Rex Ryan to witness a practice in New York, and I just need you to tell me why that's in the news.
Because Tony Dungy, who is kind of a moralistic yahoo when he's not being a self-righteous fellow, has decided that because Rex Ryan has used nasty words on the HBO show Hard Knocks in preparing his team to play the NFL season, that this is unseemly and deserved his unique brand of moral outrage. Tony Dungy is another guy who can go away as far as I'm concerned.
Do you suppose his players didn't use four-letter words when he was coaching two teams in the National Football League?
Heavens to Betsy, Bill, no.
I kind of feel the same way. Gosh. There is talk in Hollywood of a movie based on the life of quarterback Kurt Warner, who appeared in three Super Bowls and played for the winning side in two of them. Brenda Warner, Kurt's wife, was asked for a casting suggestion. Would you call her choice of actors surprising?
I really don't know where to go with this story, but I have to give Brenda Brenda Warner credit for opening vast fields for new discussion. She wants Denzel Washington to play her husband, Kurt Warner. Personally, Bill, I think he's a bit old for the role.
This week, the commissioner of the Mountain West Conference said, quote, "The Brigham Young University Cougars are a member of the Mountain West Conference." Do you think that he said that very quickly so it would still be true when he reached the end of the sentence?
Yeah, because apparently nobody knows what Brigham Young's going to do, but they appear to be leaning toward becoming a football independent, which would put them up there with Notre Dame and very few others.
Back in March, President Obama welcomed Bowl Championship Series winner Alabama to the White House, and this week ESPN calculated the cost of that trip. Any particular numbers in that accounting leap out at you, Charlie?
How is it possible to spend $3,300 at Chick-fil-A?
These are big guys.
It's a lot of I like Chick-fil-A, man. I go out of my way to eat Chick-fil-A, but $3,300 worth of Chick-fil-A?
Big linemen, big guys.
Dang.
And finally, Charlie, my understanding is that having retired this week from the NBA, Adonal Foyle has embarked on a new career as a poet. So I'd like to invite you to share with us some lines from his Love Song to a Game.
How should I tell thee goodbye? What can you say about a love affair to rival that of Romeo and Juliet? This is not just some melancholy ode to a hackneyed love of mortals. Editor's note, I love mortals myself, many of them.
Not in a hackneyed way.
Not in a hackneyed way at all. We continue. I found our love deep in the entrails of the Caribbean Sea. Editor's note, ick.
Entrails.
But we continue. I do not cry for the passing of our love, for it stands radiant while my brittle bones crumble
brittle.
Through swift times.
Bones crumble?
You have infected so many with the allure of riches and black gold.
Oh, not infected.
But I am not angry with you, my love, for to a boy who was lost in the bosom of nothing, you gave hope and home.
A bosom of nothing?
Nothing has bosoms. We continue. Like the flickering of a light, we come and go without much fuss.
Stop.
So I leave you to fend
Please
off seekers,
stop.
Hoping they too will cherish your unyielding countenance. As for me, I will forever live in the glare of your loving embrace. Embraces have a glare?
Oh,
we continue.
Loving ones.
From time to time, I hope you will look in on this pitiful fool and correct his grammar. We continue. I will miss brothers of a quilt struggling with burning lights. Editor's note, I have no idea what this man is talking about.
Burning lights?
We continue.
Don't get too close.
If I offer advice, pierce beyond the glaring lights. Editor's note, I am a pierce beyond the glaring lights. We continue. And see the faces behind the wall. Don't be fooled by magician's nibble fingers. Ed note, I think he was going for nimble there and missed.
Not nibble.
We continue. For this is a life with mirrors and screens. Its only truth lies in the understanding it will all end. The sound I will take home is the symphony of thousands of screaming friends. Ed note, the people who are reading this poem. We continue. Please stay, my immortal love. I will now leave this place of literature, go home, and drive a railroad spike through my temple. The end.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time for a discussion of poetry. Thank you, Charlie.
Thank you, Nimble Fingers.
Shaquille O'Neal is as much a pitchman, a rapper, an actor, a television personality, and a nickname magnet as he is a basketball player. Anna Kournikova was a model, a pitch woman, and a star of People magazine and E! News as much as she was a professional tennis player. In Bigger Than the Game, subtitled Bo Boz the Punky QB and How the 80s Created the Modern Athlete, Michael Weinreb explores the origin of the phenomenon of athlete as cultural icon. Michael, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
You identify the mid-1980s as the time when the modern athlete emerged, and one of those athletes was William the Refrigerator Perry, the enormous Chicago Bear, whom Monday Night Football announcer Frank Gifford proclaimed a folk hero. What led to that characterization?
Yeah, it was kind of amazing the way the fridge just popped up from out of nowhere. He's this rookie who comes into Bears camp. And Mike Ditka is the coach of the Bears, so you have a wild card right there with Mike Ditka. And he decides that he's going to stick it to Bill Walsh because Bill Walsh had used an offensive lineman as a running back in the backfield against him the year before. So he has this 300-pound lineman who, you know, hasn't actually been playing very well, had been overweight in training camp. So Ditka just decides to put him in the backfield in this game against the 49ers. And it just spirals and grows, and all of a sudden, the fridge just becomes this unbelievable marketing phenomenon. I mean, he's doing McDonald's commercials. And the thing is, you know, if you look back then, there weren't a lot of 300-pound guys in the NFL. That was really a new thing. So the fridge seemed gigantic, and it was just this perfect metaphor for where America was, too. I think, you know, we were kind of at this moment where we were fat and happy, basically, you know, and things were going well and the economy was going well and people liked Ronald Reagan. And you know, and then the fridge comes out and he's just this giant guy who's eating Big Macs, you know, and it just sort of perfectly fit into that moment in America.
Just not thinking about what those Big Macs are ultimately going to do at all.
Exactly. There was no thought about, you know, the consequences of it, which came later on in the 80s, which, you know, it's sort of That's another reason why I chose this moment, I think, is because you can see the arc of the 80s and then Reagan going from this incredibly popular figure to then the space shuttle exploding and Iran-Contra breaking and the Wall Street scandals all about to happen. And all of that, you know, the same sort of excess and the greed is good mentality really did carry over into sports.
Well, that leads to an interesting question. Could William the Refrigerator Perry have made such a splash in any other time, before or after?
I don't think he could have. I think that entire 85 Bears team was just this anomalous group of guys who just happened to come along at the right time. I think Jim McMahon, the quarterback, was really the catalyst because he really was an organic, authentic punk, you know, and he really just didn't care what people thought. And his dynamic with Mike Ditka was just this perfect situation where you had these two guys who really just went at each other constantly. But it was also just this moment where sports marketing was just beginning to exist as a concept. And so a lot of these guys were big personalities, but they were also able to develop organically, you know. So everything that happened with that team, it wasn't planned. You know, the PR people that I spoke to, they had no idea how to handle all of this. They had no idea what was coming. You know, it just all cropped up all at once. And I think because athletes are so careful about their brands today that it couldn't happen now. And obviously, nobody could have conceived of it happening before that moment in the 80s.
One of the sadder stories in your book involves the football player known as the Boz, because that's what he decided to call himself. Brian Bosworth starred for Oklahoma, of course. Then he was a bust in the National Football League and later in the movies. What earned him the right to be included with the guys who lived up to expectations on the field, at least for a time?
It's partly personal for me. I grew up a Penn State football fan, and so the genesis of this book, if I'm being honest, was the 1986 Orange Bowl when Oklahoma just beat the tar out of Penn State. Penn State was a very straight-laced program, and they were going up against this Oklahoma team that had a quarterback who carried around a Louis Vuitton purse, and they had the Boz, who was just this guy who had this horrible haircut and was just running around barking the entire game and, you know, playing up to the cameras. And, you know, he had his shirt cut off. He wore an earring. He drove a white Corvette. You know, it was just, he reminded me of what I was seeing on MTV at the time, you know, and it was this sort of new meshing of sports and entertainment.
The guy who seems to loom over bigger than the game more than anybody else is Bo Jackson, in part because he made headlines in Major League Baseball and in the NFL. You write, and I'm quoting now, "America was invested in Bo as the manifestation of its outsized dreams." Were the TV advertising campaigns, the Bo Knows ads, responsible for that level of investment?
I think so. The Michael Jordan television ads had come along a little bit earlier, but I feel like the Bo Knows ads were really that first sort of perfect manifestation of what Nike was going for in terms of turning an athlete into a mythological figure. And it just so happened that they had a guy who happened to do all these things that didn't seem humanly possible, but he would do them, we would see them on television. So it was just this perfect moment for him to become something larger than life.
Do you think guys like William Perry and Bo Jackson understood what was happening to them as they were becoming what you call icons of a world in which what they did as athletes was only a small part of their personas?
I don't think William Perry had any idea what was going on with him. It all happened so fast. He was a pretty poor kid who had grown up in South Carolina. He didn't really have a clue. Bo Jackson, I think, did know what was going on. He's a very savvy individual, very smart guy. He was a guy who really didn't like to practice that much. What he liked to do was basically prove that he could do things that nobody else could do.
And nobody thought he could do.
And that sort of fit in perfectly with the whole Bo Knows tagline. So I think he was a guy who was aware of a lot of these things in a way that a lot of guys are now.
We're now a couple of decades beyond the salad days of McMahon and Perry and Bo Jackson and the other prototype modern athletes you identify from the 80s. What, if anything, has happened to change the circumstances and the impact of today's modern athletes?
I think the speeding up of media has been a huge factor. I think the fact that these guys are now so conscious and almost overly aware of their image and branding. You look at the LeBron James situation, and I think that they were trying to create almost an 80s moment there, you know, this sort of big cultural televised moment for LeBron. And what happened was it wound up backfiring on them. So it's kind of amazing that there can be so much emphasis on branding and on imagery and all the stuff that grew out of the 80s, but yet there are still these moments where guys just don't see what the rest of us see.
Michael Weinreb is the author of Bigger Than the Game, Bo Boz, the Punky QB, and How the 80s Created the Modern Athlete. It's published by Gotham Books. Michael Weinreb joined me from NPR's New York Bureau. Thank you very much for speaking with me, Michael.
Thank you, Bill. I appreciate it.
Well, my name is Perry, but they call me the Fridge. I play football so hard I make the other teams cringe. When I first arrived, they laughed at my weight, but they saw me play and knew I was great. Now I'm making big plans, so let it be told. We're taking the Bears to the Super Bowl, so I'm warning all teams across the land. Don't mess with me, I'm the Refrigerator Man. I'm the Refrigerator Man. I'm the Refrigerator Man.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Perotti. Jack Flagler is our intern, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, listen to archived shows and stories, or learn more about our weekly music selections, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from Brian Bosworth, who, when asked how he was recruited by Oklahoma, offered this surprising insight.
I had kind of a self-esteem problem. I mean, I felt I was a very...
Sure, that might seem funny to some, but let's acknowledge Mr. Bosworth's sensitive side. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Let's go, y'all! Walter Payton and Jim McMahon too, but at the goal line they call in 72, cause there ain't nothing more feared than the attack of a 330-pound running back. Mid-pound running back, pound running back.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston. LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.